This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn, and that was the William Tell Overture, a composition some of us heard for the first time when we were much younger. We knew it then as the theme music for The Lone Ranger. Who was that masked man? From cave dwellers to astronauts, masks have been part of the human experience around the world for tens of thousands of years. The St. Louis Art Museum has organized an exhibition that features masks from 50 countries on six continents. There are close to 150 masks on display. 30 of them are on view with full costumes. They range from prehistoric times to the present. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, a closer look at the power and meaning of masks and the St. Louis Art Museum's exhibition, Masks, Faces of Culture. The exhibition runs through January 2nd in St. Louis. An abridged showing opens at the Field Museum in Chicago on February 19th. It will run through May 14th. Our guests this afternoon, the exhibition's curators, Kara McCarty and John Nunley. They are also co-authors of the show's catalog. Also joining us, art historian Giselle Atterbury. She teaches at Illinois State University in Normal. Kara McCarty, the Grace and Richard Broombaugh Curator of Decorative Arts and Design, and John Nunley, the Morton Curator of the Arts of Africa, Oceania, and the Americas, join us from the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. Giselle Atterbury is here with me in Urbana. Listeners, join us with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Well, greetings from Urbana to St. Louis.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Kara, John, how are you?
Good, and you?
We're fine here. Giselle is with me in the studio.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi, nice to have you back on the program.
Oh, well, thanks very much. Nice to be here.
This is a beautiful exhibition.
Thank you.
First, our thanks and our congratulations. What was the genesis of this exhibition, Masks, Faces of Culture?
The genesis really was it was an outgrowth of work that both John Nunley and I had been doing for years separately and on masks. John was working more on African masks and Caribbean masks, and I was focusing more on 20th century design protective masks. And in 1993, we were talking and about masking and reasons why people mask, and we decided that there are a lot of universal reasons, common reasons why people mask from all time periods, all cultures, and committed at that time to doing an exhibition.
Mm. Now, I would imagine that if we went out on the street this afternoon and asked folks on the street, what are masks used for? I guess a couple of answers would come immediately to mind. Masks are used for entertainment, and maybe someone would say masks are used for celebration, but that's really just part of the story. John, perhaps you would talk with us about how humankind has used and continues to use masks.
Well, masks are used to entertain and to celebrate in the sense that they're used in a performative context where people find reasons to get together to solve problems, whether it has to do with rites of passage or renewal or offense-defense situations or theater, or when men, for example, play men as women. There are these sort of universal needs, and for some reason, the mysterious reason, masks become a very powerful cultural tool to celebrate these occasions of that call upon the satisfaction of human needs. One of the things in the show that Kara and I were and are concerned about is that regardless of the situation, there is a context where people perform, whether they're a SWAT team coming in on a drug raid at 6 o'clock in the morning or Halloween trick-or-treaters coming in at 6 o'clock at night. The situation is that you have the masquerader and you have the people who are around it in this context that brings them together in difficult situations, friendly situations, aggressive and conflicting situations.
Mm. So masks are something we use with one another.
Yeah, I would say so, Kara.
Yes, in fact, I think that was something that we articulated at one point during the exhibition, is that you really need at least one other person in order for a mask to mean something.
And it seems we have a need for masks that is both utilitarian and spiritual.
Yes. You know, it's, I think when we come together as people in societies and we invent roles and we create social relationships that are sanctified by laws and rules and codes of behavior, you need masking situations which explore all those dimensions of human relationships to kind of solidify those relationships. Or if they're not working well, the masks in performance can say that and say, we need to change direction here, things like that. But there's also another kind of underlying significance to them. This has to do with the dilemma of us being human beings as cultural products, but also being biological objects. And in the exhibition, all through, there's this sense of the contradiction between being human culturally and being biologically animals. I think one of the pieces, one of the objects that really brings this forward is the Aztec mask, which is a skull, which is the physiological part of us, the animal part of us, and it's embedded with the cultural manifestation of us, which would be a jade mask, which is made out of tiny pieces of jade that are glued, adhered to the face of the mask. So you have this coming together of culture and biology, which, you know, they go in two different ways. Biology has its own agenda and culture has its own agenda, and masks tend to try to mediate what can be very explosive and very dangerous.
John, I remember that mask quite well, and at least from a late 20th century perspective, the additional stonework across the skull tended to aestheticize the skull and remove it from the gruesome or the morbid, and it really, again, in a very peculiar sort of way, became an object of really great beauty in the way that a skull in a medical textbook could never be.
Yeah, again, this is, you hit on something very important, I think, is that we aestheticize of some very raw feelings that we have as animals, and masks tend to help that out. We begin to bypass what might be a sacrifice of a human being for the aesthetics of the dance and the beauty of the obsidian dagger that makes that happen. But way down there, beyond the aesthetic, there is still that very grueling and, I think, dark side of humanity that Kara has really explored in Offense, Defense.
Kara, did you want to
hop
in?
Excuse me. I that aestheticizing is really very fascinating, and I think that in that section of the exhibition in particular, where that skull mask is, it's in the burial section of the show, and there's a whole group of, as you saw, magnificent masks, and those are some of the most resplendent in the entire exhibition, because those masks were made to memorialize the dead for infinity, really. And all of those masks are made of very durable materials, and some of them, as you saw, are made of gold, the jade or turquoise, or we saw one which we were not able to borrow for the exhibition, but it was made out of this really juicy black obsidian, which is a very difficult material to work in, but they were really made to memorialize the dead. And also there was that wonderful Egyptian mask. And these are great statements, make great statements about the societies for which they were made. They're very confident, very powerful societies. And so these are statements about the deceased, who were often the rulers, but also about the society as a whole.
There's a mask in the exhibition, the oldest in the exhibition. It resembles a skull, and to my eye, I remember it having a smile.
Yeah, I remember that piece.
Maybe the two of you there in St. Louis would talk with us about that mask and how might it have been used. How old is it, too? Would you tell us?
The mask is dates from about 3,000 to 5,000 BC, and it's our oldest actual mask in the exhibition. And there's different speculation exactly to how it was used. It was a burial mask, and they're not certain if it was actually placed on the face of the deceased or in a niche next to the burial chamber of the deceased. But when you look at the mask and along the top rim, there you see piercings. So there is an indication that there was perhaps something tied into it. Sometimes we see hairs or grasses coming out of similar type masks, but it also could have been tied onto the deceased as well. It's a little bit hard. I'm not sure we will ever know.
Yeah. Does it seem to be smiling to you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it is smiling. I think of a song that just came to my mind, "Smile When You're Feeling Blue." You know, smile when you're feeling dead. down in South America in Chancay, you get these smiling figures, and then Tajin, you get smiling figures in Veracruz. And they're performing these rituals, and you'll find figures that are in clay, and they're rendered being punished on racks, and they're smiling as well. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I think the skull itself, if maybe Kara will think about this with Halloween imagery, and skulls, when they do not have the flesh on them, those big teeth and the gaping jaw almost does look like a smile. So, you know, when the Grim Reaper's coming along and smiling at you, it's more of a horrific smile. I don't find it a friendly smile. I find it really kind of a haunting, kind of gaping smile.
That was a curious thing about many masks in the show, is that they seem to embody different types of emotions or different sorts of reactions all at once. And, you know, to communicate this across time and across different cultures is really rather miraculous and captivating. One thing I'd hope that anyone interested in seeing the show would realize is this is a really very vital type of show. You see costumes, you see video, you understand how these masks are used in context. There are sounds piped into the rooms in occasions where you can hear music that would accompany the masks.
Video and, that offers context.
Right, right. And it's a very unusual sort of show because the theme is so broad and so far-reaching. And it's a very different kind of a show in just so many different ways. You walk through, the lighting is different from room to room. The display of the masks can be at eye level or not, rather surprising ways. And you end up drawing conclusions about masks created by different cultures and different points in time. And again, I think this notion of universalizing concerns comes through very strongly. And I really like the way you've concentrated on things like rites of passage and so forth. But even the idea of men as women as a major theme. I wouldn't have thought that was a major theme, but the show certainly brought that out, that masks have been used that way. But very dynamic show.
Thank you very much. Excuse me, it sounds like you got it. It's very pleasing to hear you to say all these comments, because we really worked very hard to convey the range of things that you just referred to, and we really identified these themes, these categories, very early on, and wanted them to be clear to people. If nothing else, they walk out of the exhibition having seen 150 extraordinary masks, and they have some themes to think about as they go around in their daily life, and hopefully they'll leave the exhibition looking at the world a bit differently, because it's an exhibition that I felt, and I have seen hundreds of exhibitions in my life. This is really about us as humans, and I think anyone, especially who's ever put on a mask, and that's most of us at some point in our life, can relate to the exhibition. And I think that we've articulated in the show many things that we take for granted. You asked early on in the program about if you ask the average person why people mask, they might come up with a couple reasons. But I think that after this show, we have articulated these reasons for the people. And there's something else that I wanted to go back to that you had just mentioned, and that is the expressions on some of the masks' faces, because, again, masks are made for people to respond to. As we said early on, we need another person. When we wear a mask, in order for it to be effective, we need at least one other person, and that is the viewer, and maybe that viewer is a spirit. I mean, that's another reason to don a mask. But we have these expressions, and we're meant to respond to the masks, but there are a lot of common expressions and characters throughout the exhibition and throughout the different cultures that I think our exhibition really plays out. For example, yesterday we were walking through, and we've never really counted up, but there are a lot of monkey figures throughout the exhibition. There's a lot of demon figures throughout the show, and that was a very interesting part, another interesting discovery for us, because even when you look at some contemporary mask from our Western society, like Darth Vader, we all get it. He symbolizes evil. It's this dark, menacing figure, and yet we see bits of masks from many different cultures embodied in Darth Vader.
I was curious about the choice of Darth Vader. Excuse me. Saw a billboard on the way into the art museum, and it seems that the Darth Vader mask has figured fairly prominently in the promotion of the show. Were you targeting a younger audience than typical?
We were targeting a broad range of people, which we always try to do. But this show certainly lends itself to younger audiences, and they've been a very active component of our attendance, and the guards have been telling us that they've never seen children so animated in one of our exhibitions before.
And Celeste and I were talking about that before the show, how much the young people were
really
talking about the show.
Really, yeah. Into it. On their hands and knees, crawling around and, you know, looking at things from various perspectives, writing notes, but doing it cheerfully,
right?
Yeah, it's great to witness, and we also have adults. I mean, so many adults have never received a response on any show that like this before, but everybody, whatever age range the people are from, they're responding to it, and they're really understanding it, and it's just the response, overwhelming response, has just been wow.
Yeah.
Right, and it's not an unsophisticated show at all. I mean, I can certainly see why it would be captivating for young people, but there's enough wall text that specialists, anthropologists, people in the arts, artists would be very. I think they might be drawn to want to read more, but it's not superficial. It's not a quick and easy sort of show. If you really want to take time to go through it, you need to take the time. But it's just, such a happy mesh when you can see young people going through and absolutely fascinated, and then obviously other people looking for specific examples, which they really want to examine in great detail. It's a very successful show.
I'm glad to hear that you observe the interest of young people in the exhibition, because in most of the cultures represented, young people are sort of indoctrinated, are exposed to these masquerades, as you said, at a very early age, before they really develop their language skills and other communication skills. And the visual power of those masks, and you were talking about the individual gazes, the smiles, different expressions, really do fixate on young people. I've seen this in Africa and in South America and the Caribbean. Young people at age 4 and 5 become so transfixed by these experiences that whenever they see these masquerades in their adult life, those same emotions and same experiences, very hot, seething kinds of experiences at times, are recalled, so they carry that image and that feeling with them from day 4 on up to when they're older. And we're also pleased that you see that there are many levels of this exhibition, because Kara and I saw it that way, and refreshingly, as curators, we really enjoy just looking at the masks themselves, and you can discard the text, you can discard wall text and so forth, and do it on that level. And also, when you just look at the objects, you learn a lot about function, about design, about the materials that are used, how those materials reflect different environments, flora and fauna, availability of industrial supplies, and so forth. So thank you. I think you've given us a good grade on that.
Well, yeah, I really respect the show for what it does that way. I was particularly taken by a couple of young women who looked to be about high school age who were discussing a mask by Oskar Schlemmer, which I think it was done about 1929 during the Bauhaus years. And one said to the other, this has to be from the 1950s. Look at the color. And the other one says, oh, yeah, probably the 50s. You know, look at the curve and the line and so forth. And then they read the text together. And 1929, so early. Is this a misprint? Mm-hmm. What is this? And, I mean, they were really looking very carefully, very analytically, thinking about design. And it struck me at that point in time that so many shows are designed by art historians, which is a good thing, but they are targeted to art historians. And I've never forgotten what one of my teachers once said about art museums, that they're really like libraries for artists. And I would think this, for a visual artist, would just be a feast. And in fact, I was lucky enough to see the show with an artist friend of mine, and she really just loved looking at the masks. And I'm sure she was absorbing them in ways that I'm not capable of doing. As a historian, you get a little dry and removed from things, I think. But I would think it would be an incredibly inspirational show from the standpoint of design, the use of materials, color, the impact of color. It would just have to be very powerful to see in just formal terms as well.
Well, thank you. That was it was a lot of fun to work on the design of this exhibition, and we worked with an outside designer named Alex Castro, who's done some other exhibitions at the museum, and we've worked with him extensively on this. And since from the very beginning, I remember there was a word that John and I kept coming up with, that we wanted this to be a sense of a journey. We wanted people to walk through the show, to move through it, and to discover the masks. And I think that was really achieved in the installation. For those of people who have not seen it, the interior is primarily black, so it's dark, and it has this mysterious sense to it, quality, as soon as one enters the exhibition, and you know that you have passed from the daylight into this darkened womb-like space. We began with a cave. We felt that was really important, a section of a cave, because that's where some of the masking really began, down in rock shelters. And then we wanted to continue from there. And most of the walls in the exhibition are diagonal walls. And every time when the public starts to get comfortable, you round a diagonal wall, and there's another surprise ahead, just as soon as you start to think maybe you can coast. And we've used, as you mentioned, sound at a few pivotal moments, because one has to think, especially with masks were made to be performed. So we didn't want a sense of a really static space. We wanted the sense of this excitement, this discovery, this mystery. And most of the masking traditions are accompanied by a lot of movement, by sound, and we have a couple videos in the exhibition, too, showing how the masks are used today. And those are immensely popular. And then we have just so many extraordinary masks that are on these critical axes to begin a new section. And then at the end, it was really fun playing with materials. We created in the offense-defense corridor, the last quarter of the exhibition, we wanted people to, again, we didn't want people to become too easy. Again, one is not easy usually when either wearing or confronted by a mask. And again, we have this wonderful industrial flooring, metal walls that almost when you walk through this long, narrow space, it's like you're between two battleships having a face-off. And culminating with this wonderful Apollo 15 full spacesuit, including the mask and helmet. And it's this great crescendo in the exhibition, this great moment that's sort of hovering at the end and has this wonderful facing when one turns around at the exhibition, which I hope the public will do, turn around and look back at this fantastic Siberian shaman's garment and mask that was collected in 1770. And it's so rare that it even exists, because usually they were buried along with the shaman at death. And those are very key moments in the exhibition, because shamanism is a theme that runs throughout the show from the very beginning, from the moment one enters the exhibition. And it has to do with flight and our fantasies of about exploring other environments. And I think the shaman really is about trying to touch the divine. And we've always, as humans, had this dialogue with the cosmos. And then to end the show with this wonderful protective spacesuit and helmet that is, you know, protection is one of the primary uses for wearing masks, and to have this wonderful Apollo astronaut that really has taken humankind off our planet onto the moon, and to look back at our wonderful planet and really the journey that the public has just experienced going through our exhibition.
Yeah. I'd like to talk about the shaman costume and mask. It seems to me that this is multi-masking. The robe is decorated with masks. There's a good deal of metal. The costume is made of reindeer skin. And some of the metal along the shoulders in the back sticks out, antler-like. Mm-hmm. But the Siberian shamans called their garments bird skins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the many layers on that costume, each layer is kind of a level of power that goes deeper and deeper into, you know, the space of spiritual power. The outer layers are less effective, but as you penetrate it, it gets much more powerful. And remember that the shaman would have been moving and spinning around, so the inner layers would have been revealed as the outer layers of lapis and materials spread out. It is a bird costume, so this person, like the image of Lascaux, the cave painting at the very beginning of the galleries, the man wearing the bird mask, this person would have been in a sense of flight as well, to reach that spirit world, either to bring back a spirit of someone who was sick, or to negotiate with spirits in that world to create a healthier environment for the living, or to make sure the caribou would come through. And the interesting thing about flight and caribou, there's so many dimensions to that costume. The caribou in that area often eat the mushroom fly agaric, and the peoples in that region would often butcher an animal like that who had eaten the fly agaric, which is the mushroom that causes intoxication and sense of transformation. They would eat the meat and themselves by association with the, I guess we call them reindeers in our culture, but caribou, would go into a sense of flight. Think about in terms of our mythologies about Santa Claus, which derives from Siberia. Those caribou are up there flying with that sled, and Santa Claus is wearing red and white, and the fly agaric is itself red and white. But multiple personalities in that shaman. You're right. If you look at the masks, there are other masks hanging on the side of that guy, and one of those masks has perforations of holes going around the rim. And I don't know for sure, but that shaman may have exchanged masks during a ritual to create other personalities to forge ahead with what had to be done in that spirit world. We know for certain that shamans in the Northwest Coast, and that shamanism derives from shamanism Siberia, often would go through three or four masks on their quest to heal their patients, because one personality might not do it. And so you have that. Another thing about the shaman, and when we... You know, these are simple things that you only discover by hands-on activity. We lifted the shaman into place on that pedestal in that room, and it made wonderful sounds of bell-like sounds. You know, think back to the shaman rendering at Lascaux and that bird rattle, which is probably making it sound like shh, 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 which is not biological at all. It's a very odd sound. It's a cultural fabricated sound. You get that sound calling the spirits or repelling the spirits. They go into the bell cultures, into the alpine regions, and there, these costumes with the bells are like walking altars, and they're also calling the spirits or repelling the spirits. The church bells, which do the same thing, and then you got the Siberian shaman. And so the bells, the sound of bells, the sound of the spirit world is just as much part of the masking, I guess, acoustic mask as those visual masks are.
Yeah. I would just like to add one more thing to that that you had asked about was the antler-like prongs on lining the shaman's shoulders. And they're not really certain if those are antlers or not, but what was very interesting is that if you noticed in seeing the exhibition that behind the shaman we placed this very large photo blow-up, which is a detail from one of the deep field images taken by the Hubble telescope of the Milky Way galaxy. Excuse me, which is the furthest that human beings have been able to see. And again, shamans have been trying, you know, to they go to other spaces than our own to negotiate with the spirits. And when the director of the lending institution came to see the installation, he saw the large photo blow up, and he said, "That's right, because those metal prongs lining the shaman's shoulder were meant to connect the shaman with the stars."
That's interesting. I noticed in the catalog and in some of the wall texts that you actually commissioned a number of costumes. Was that either of you or both of you specifically, or other curators involved with that?
No, but Kara and I, we both did that. Kara, do you want to talk about the Sardinian ones, and I'll say a little bit about...
Yes, we had a great time actually commissioning some of the masks and costumes, and the reason we did in all the cases was because the ones we really wanted were not available, and you have to think that some of these are performed, this exhibition lasts for a year, and so that we would be using the masks, wanting the masks and costumes during these societies' annual festivals. So they're very attached to their costumes and masks. So in most, those are the cases primarily where we did commission them. And we... one of the things that we really wanted to do in this exhibition was to present some masks and costumes that are not well known to the American public. And one of those areas is European masking. We often think about other cultures, tribal cultures, as doing the masking, but we do so much today in the West, in North America and Europe, and we don't really articulate that. And so we thought, well, everyone is familiar with Venetian Carnival and masks, so we didn't want to show all the obvious, and we began investigating European masking and turned up some wonderful masking traditions. And so someone tipped us off to Sardinia, and we made a trip there over one weekend. We were both sort of, John and I were intersecting in Europe, and met with the director of the Ethnographic Museum in Nuoro, who had a marvelous display of their Sardinian masks in costumes, and we decided skins or goat skins and bells, but very stylishly Italian. And actually, there's quite there's a lot to be read, as John said earlier, just gleaned from the masks themselves without anyone even really telling you the history of them. They're just so marvelously Italian, almost something that Giorgio Armani might design. And then facing those, we have some wonderful Bulgarian costumes that John
commissioned.
That
Bulgarian costume was out of this world. I would have never anticipated something like that.
Isn't that great?
That's great to hear that, because we didn't either. We sort of had a glimpse of Bulgaria. We were at the Museum of Man in Paris several years ago. We were downstairs looking at some Romanian and Bulgarian costumes, and I looked at Kara and I said, "What blank is this?" You know, and they were pretty incredible. We lit up. We thought, "This is a part of masking. It's in Western Europeans' own backyard." In fact, many Europeans don't know about these costumes. These are mountain villages and so forth. So we like these guys, these furry kind of cone-head goatskin guys.
Yeah, they're head
huge.
To toe.
Pardon?
Head to toe fur.
That's right.
Leather.
Yeah.
And for folks in the audience, you can kind of get an idea maybe by thinking back to the Addams Family and Cousin It.
Yeah, that's right.
It would be close.
It'd be
I mean,
close.
That's not fair, but at least folks would get some idea. It's just head to toe, long fur.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, I went to Bansko, this little ski town about an hour and a half out of Sofia. And to give you a sense of the daily life of what you'd call farmers, peasants, merchants, or whatever, we met up with Bastrini, Mr. Demeter Bastrini, who's been masquerading in these costumes for a long, long time. In fact, the black one, the black goat's costume, is the highest prestige one, and he has one of those himself. But you go to his house, and we sat down. We looked at some videotapes of these performances through the years, these New Year's performances. And then we went out to the barn in the back, and before you hit the barn, there's an arbor of grapes, and of course they make their own wines and so forth. And a new lamb was born the day that I was there, and the chickens are in there, rabbits are in there, and he also works as a subcontractor. So these are not exoticized people. These are people that are working in the cash economy, but also in a trade and barter economy. And at the same time, they've held on these traditions. We don't know how far back they go, but we do know that they withstood the assault of Islam for about 600 years and the communist regime for 50 years. So they really have rallied around these masquerades as identity forces. And you can see us as outsiders going, wow, far out, what is that? This is weird. It's a strong visual image. It serves to connect the village.
And one thing about the show, I think the lighting and sometimes the juxtapositions, I mean, one thing a person could take away as a criticism is just weirdness from these various types of masks and costumes. But I would think by making the way through the show, the entire journey through the show, that you would begin to see, again, these more universalizing tendencies, and it would tend to dispel the notion that these are bizarre sorts of things to do. There's just extremes, one to another, of different types of masking. But certainly that Bulgarian costume was an extreme. It was very surprising, and wow, it would be frightening in some contexts. And yes, it's big and warm and woolly, and up in the mountains, it might be kind of, you know, it really, I would think, would depend on context. The Swiss costumes in the same
that
room were horribly surprising to me, too. I've never seen anything like those. I have to admit, my first thought was of the Von Trapp family. If they were going over the mountains and encountered right. these. Uh-huh. Yeah. I don't know if Edelweiss. They would have turned around. They were, even the ones that were described as the pretty costumes were kind of morbidly particularized and just
what are the materials
obsessive.
In these costumes, and what do they look like for the listening audience? We have to.
Well, the ugly costumes, I believe, had hay or straw.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and then the pretty costumes, there were these little tableaux as part of the hats where you could see farmers and almost like the top of a horribly elaborated wedding cake.
Absolutely.
But they
very
were
good.
Just
you get an most, A for that.
Most peculiar, and I wouldn't have associated that with Swiss bankers and watchmakers for anything.
And cocoa.
Right, right. These people were really, really getting their yayas out when they put those things on.
Well, think about what are you going to do in a mountain village when it snows and you're tied up there, you know? You can play cards in the tavern so much, but you got to let loose. You want winter to shake its wings and fly away. You want the new spring to come in.
Mm. Kara, your essay on masks in the catalog used in Offense and Defense, you write of reading the New York Times one day.
Yes.
And seeing five photographs of masks used to illustrate the day's articles.
Yes.
Bomb squad, beekeeper's hood, a baseball catcher's mask, and masks worn by two protagonists in a new movie coming out.
Yes.
In our culture, are masks most often worn as protective covering?
Well, that's certainly one of the big areas where they are worn, and especially I think in recent years because we've become such a litigious society that protection and safety, health and safety in so many aspects of our life is really being played up. And I certainly noticed this as I travel around the world and see other countries where that aren't so well off, where they don't really emphasize the health and safety nearly in the way that the United States does. So I think it's almost become a luxury that we're doing it in so many aspects of our life. And by that I mean certainly in sports, And that's an area, actually, that for so long was, you find so much machoism, that many athletes did not want to wear a mask because it would show that they might be weak or afraid. And we have, a hockey mask, goaltender's masks in our society. And it wasn't really until the 1970s that hockey players were required, professional hockey players were required to wear masks. But if you learn about how violent hockey can be, and it was Jacques Plante who wore the first mask in 1959, and that was after he wore it at practice, but he was not allowed to wear it during the actual public games. And that was, he finally insisted to wear it after he had had his nose severed. I forgot how many times, but it was dozens and dozens of times. And finally his nose had been severed so bad that it was just dangling there. And at halftime they sewed it back on, and he agreed to go back on the ice if he could wear his mask. And we find this in a lot of sports where even children today are being required to wear masks and helmets in sports. So our times have really changed, and this is certainly, there's a lot more acceptance just to see them, acceptance by the audience, but also the performers. We see it in casual sports, bicycle riding. We see it in certainly traditional uses of forms of combat, which are reflect our times today with the terrorism and biological warfare. A lot of these mass war for combative purposes are really part of sort of this vicious arms race that humans have entered into over the centuries. And then one other area, as you mentioned, where we see them a lot today, and I think we'll be seeing them even more, is in the movies. That's why we did include Darth Vader's mask. But movies are where we often find characters who are beyond the ordinary, both in terms of their abilities or appearance. And so often, if you think about who in the movies has worn the masks, it's often the monsters, the human beings termed monsters, the evil characters, or like someone like Superman with lots of good powers. And we opened the program today with a Lone Ranger, I noticed. So he's certainly a part of our culture, too. And I really believe that with the computer animation, as good as it has now gotten, where we know in films we see a lot of shape-shifting, characters transforming seamlessly from one character to another, I actually think we'll be seeing more and more masks in the theater, or people, characters transforming from a human to some other creature, something that we've been trying to do for centuries with masks.
Yeah, in that essay, Kara, you write, masks continue to be, no matter what the culture, mediators between the wearer and the world. We're out of time here. We have to wrap up. But before we go, as we're speaking about the need to protect, there's a mask in the exhibition, a firefighter's respirator. Circa 1910, it's French.
Oh, yes.
It's horrible and beautiful at the same time.
Almost tragic quality about it.
And yet, I also wonder if this wasn't some of, didn't serve to inspire the Star Wars character.
3PCO, yes. I knew that's what you were leading up to. And I had the exact same thought. I don't know, and I'd actually like to ask George Lucas or his one of his mask designers, because that certainly was known at the time. It was very well published, and it reminds me of one of the characters that was used in Fritz Lang's film Metropolis. It certainly reminds me of the protagonist there. And I also know that abstract mask that you referred to earlier with the teenagers looking at it, Oscar Schlemmer's mask, he designed a very similar mask as well in the 1920s. So, again, as we see throughout the exhibition, we see a lot of similar forms and shapes recurring throughout the centuries.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry to say we've got to wrap it up here. We're out of time. I want to thank our guests in St. Louis this afternoon, Kara McCarty and John Nunley, for joining us at the studios of KWMU in St. Louis. The exhibition Masks, Faces of Culture runs through January 2nd in St. Louis, and a bridged showing opens at the Field Museum in Chicago on February 19th. It runs through May 14th. Also, my thanks this afternoon to art historian Giselle Atterbury here with me in the studio. She teaches at Illinois State University in Normal. And by the way, let me give you the website for the St. Louis Art Museum. It's www.slam.org.